This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. An unlikely friendship begins in the Paramount Plus original movie, Little Wing, starring Brooklyn Prince with Kelly Riley and Brian Cox. Reeling from her parents' divorce, Caitlin steals a valuable bird to save her home, but instead forms a bond with the owner, leading to a new outlook on life. Little Wing, now streaming exclusively on Paramount Plus. Head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Rated PG-13.
So there we are with the Sgt. Pepper reprise coming at the end of the album as sort of this way of tying this alleged concept together for the Pepper album. If I'm not mistaken, that bit was suggested by Neil Aspinall.
Yeah, who, that's what I've read.
Yeah, outside of the group, managed to realize that, hey, you know, what is a concept about this album going to be? You know, you got to throw something at that. And that's the unadorned basic track. As Lennon would say to George Martin, without all your production crap on it.
Yeah.
Showing the Beatles playing as a band. So here we are with Sgt. Pepper, this album that Rolling Stone put at the top of their list of 500 greatest rock albums of all time. Notwithstanding, it's probably not even the best Beatle album. But what was interesting was a year or two ago, or maybe in the last year, Entertainment Weekly, did you see their list of all the greatest rock albums?
Nope.
Pepper wasn't even on the list. But number one was Revolver.
Interesting. What other Beatle albums were in there?
Abbey Road was in there, I think, somewhere. I can't remember the exact order, but Revolver was at top, and conspicuously absent was Sgt. Pepper. So, you know, talk about clickbait and wanting to provoke people.
Did they have votes for it? Or
I don't know. It was Entertainment Weekly. So,
right.
you look at their demographic, and it certainly doesn't overlap much with Rolling Stone.
Right.
But the point being, you know, here, in the wake of my book, the critical opinion is swinging more toward Revolver. Saying it's cause and effect, but it just is.
Yeah, but then again, if you remember the Roy Carr, Tony Tyler book, the, you know, Beatles illustrated record from, what was it, like 75?
Yes.
In that, it seems to infer that Revolver is the album, because it sort of says that at any point in any artist's career, this would be a fine achievement. In 75, which is, what, 8 years after Pepper, it's already saying that Pepper's dated.
And that was a real outlier, because that was by no means the critical consensus at that point. I really think the turning point in more recent years, which I'm talking like, you know, late 80s into the 90s, was when the CDs were issued. And finally in America, you got the 14-track iteration that they put out. Then things started to turn more toward Revolver's favor. Whereas it had been Pepper, Pepper, Pepper. And, you know,
there was an article as well in, I'm trying to think, it was either NME or Melody Maker in the mid-70s. Trying to remember the name of the guy who wrote it. I think he's one of your Facebook friends. And the headline on it was like, you know, was Pepper the worst album the Beatles ever made?
Charles Shar Murray,
that's it. Uh-huh. And I remember, you know, he basically was making a case for that. Mm-hmm. You know, he was kind of going against the tide, obviously.
And really, it seems like a lot of that is echoing Richard Goldstein from Village Voice, who nailed it. He was the one that called out the glory that was Revolver when it was made in 66, virtually alone. I mean, there was no real rock journalism infrastructure in 66. And by 67, there was much more of it, and that was really when the establishment press was ready to acknowledge rock music as capable of producing art, And lo and behold, there was pepper that was just unmistakable. I mean, everything about it was calculated to draw attention to itself, from the cover art to the hype that surrounded it, you know, the lyrics on the back cover. You know, the Beatles were not going to get ignored twice the way they were with Revolver.
Right. And you know, I wouldn't want to go the other way and start really slagging off Pepper. It's, you know, still an unbelievable album.
It's
not my favorite, but some of the tracks on there are absolutely just fantastic.
There is some great work on there. But, you know, and again, I'm not here to tell people what should be their favorite album. But I think, number one...
I am.
It was got way more laudatory things said about it, well beyond what it should have got.
Yeah, but that was the impact it had at the time.
It was the effect it had at its time. But it's like seeing a live band for the first time. It's like, you know, if they're really good, they will never be as good as the first time you see them. And afterwards, there's going to be diminishing returns, no matter how well they perform, because you can only have that impact once. And at this distance with Pepper, you know, the ripples have long since dissipated. In its time, I'm sure, and I know, it made a great splash. The presentation, you know, the sociological impact it had, the impact it had on rock in terms of, you know, transforming the cachet from the hit single to the album-length statement.
You know, I remember, like, you know, interviewing Bruce Botnick, who engineered and then produced The Doors, right? And he said they had an advanced copy of the album, and they were listening to it in the studio, and it was just blown away by
right.
it. And, you know, we know what the impact it had on Brian Wilson.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it did.
Undeniably.
Yeah.
But it's like once that cloud dissipates and you're left with what there actually is there, and I'm not even talking about it being hyped as a concept album or the first concept album or any of that nonsense, just song by song. I personally, without telling people what should be their favorite album, I find the work they did on Revolver song for song on a higher level than what they did for Pepper. I mean, can you compare Paul's tracks on Pepper, When I'm 64, She's Leaving Home, Fixing a Hole, Getting Better, to Eleanor Rigby, Got to Get You Into My Life, Here, There, and Everywhere for No One. It's like he was killing it on Revolver. And the following year, you know, the emphasis seems to be much more on the production than the songcraft, to my ears.
Yeah, and also it's kind of interesting if you link that, if we jump over the White Album and go to Abbey Road, you know, you sort of see that you've got this, as you said, very loose concept. They had the idea, you know, McCartney's idea, and then they just try and tie it up neatly with a bow at the end by having the Sgt. Pepper reprise and having some crowd sounds, and it's like, oh, okay, it's the end of the show.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing that goes on in between that suggests the show, that's for sure.
Exactly.
And then you get to Abbey Road, you know, and you've got, like, side two of Abbey Road, and it's absolutely everything that McCartney wants to do with George Martin.
Yes.
And certainly not what John wants to do.
No.
But it's like this time, well, Paul had more leverage by then. As we know, John had kind of withdrawn.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
The finished result was this compromise between a collection of individual tracks, which was side one, and then you had side two, which was George Martin and Paul asserting their ambitions to do something different. And, you know, they had all these half-finished songs laying around. Mm. Let's create this, you know, symphonic piece out of them. And I don't know if you ever read this, but I seem to recall reading somewhere that originally there was thought to switching the sides. Side two was going to be the first side.
Really?
Yeah, and they were going to end with that cold cut of I Want You, She's So Heavy.
Right.
Yeah, which, you know, obviously it didn't work out that way, but that would have been very interesting as a way to end a Beatles album.
Yeah, because actually it would have worked quite well. The problem is, I think, if you flip the two sides and you start with that whole suite, you know, being side one, you're then going to want side two to continue that thing.
Yeah, nowhere to go but down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas this way it builds into it, doesn't it?
I think they did the right thing, but I think if John had gotten his way, it would have given him his closing album track on a Beatle album one more time.
Yeah.
Which is something
But I have to say, the first time I heard Abbey Road, it did have the right effect, because it was like, okay, you got these great individual tracks on side one, and then side two just never lets up. You know, it takes off and never lands until the end.
And that's how it should be, rising toward a peak. I mean, it ends the way it should end.
Yeah.
But
And also, what a way to end their recording career.
Right.
You know,
and that's the thing about it is, you know, they have said in interviews that, no, we didn't go in there thinking this was going to be the last time we're working together. Nonetheless, the last
song... George Martin didn't say that to me. George Martin, you know, when I interviewed him in 87, said, you know, I think we all kind of knew this was going to be.
Yeah, he has said that, but the Beatles themselves, just like the August 22, 1969 shoot at Tittenhurst, well, we didn't go there thinking it was the last time we were going to be photographed together as a band.
Well, that's fair enough.
That's fair enough, but you see it in them. And maybe that was their being in denial about how badly things had deteriorated to that point.
But I think if you... Doesn't George in Anthology... I know Ringo says that, you know, the last bars of the last song, I wasn't thinking this is my last drum beat, you know, on the final song. But George pretty much infers that this was it, that we knew we were going to do one more, and this was it.
I think that in his head, he'd already kind of moved on anyway.
Yeah.
It's very striking to me. If you look at the songs he was writing circa 69, he seemed to have made a distinction in his head between what would be George Harrison material and what would be Beatle material.
He'd had his fill of having stuff rejected.
Yeah, I mean, he comes in like gangbusters, you know, having been to America in December of 68, getting his creative and artistic due from people he respected, like Dylan and the band and all these musicians, comes back, once again he's put back in the junior partner role, yet he's bringing in Let It Down and Hear Me Lord and All Things Must Pass mm-hmm. and all this top-notch stuff. And they, you know, are met with complete disinterest from his bandmates, as usual. And thereafter, he seems to be submitting for consideration just the stuff that's harmless enough and lightweight enough that the Beatles can get behind it, and it's not necessarily going to pose an artistic threat that he's really going to deep uncharted waters as a Beatle within that band. You know, he's giving them For You Blue and Old Brown Shoe.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it, really, if you think about it? As a collective, Lennon-McCartney anyway, certainly, you know, as you said, they've still kind of, you know, got George in this kind of headlock, you know, and, you know, not letting him just express himself. And as you said, you know, they've still got to dominate, even when John has got only half-finished songs and things, right? On the other hand, from Lennon's perspective, as the guy who started the band and always wanted to be cutting edge, he wants to bring Yoko in, and they're not receptive to that. And there are two sides to that. I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I can see Lennon's perspective on it. It's like, you know what, we've done the star thing. We've done the concert thing. We've done Pepper and, you know, and being lauded for that. And now let's do something else if we want to stay cutting edge. Otherwise, you know, what we're going to end up with, you know, we're going to end up with Ram.
Well, you know? Which is not a bad thing. But
the
problem with Lennon
is, according to me,
is his failure to recognize it. You know, fine if you're not digging Oblah Di Oblah Da or Maxwell Silver Hammer, if you're not really getting behind a lot of the stuff that Paul's doing, you completely overlook what Paul brought to your material and how you were never better than when Paul was behind you and helping out. He was never better than when all the Beatles were invested in his material, and that's a fact. You know, he can look back at the White Album and say, well, I like my collection of songs better than that album. Fair enough. They are good songs. They're good performances.
But I think actually they're great songs.
They are
outstanding performances.
They are. I would not take that away from him. But at the same time, the stuff that is the most iconic Beatle material that he originated is the stuff that they were all invested in. Whether it be Come Together, you know, late in their career, whether it be I Am the Walrus, Strawberry Fields Forever, where he was able to take in what they brought to the table, he was never better.
I don't think he'd have ever denied that, even in 1970, you know, when he was on his rant for Rolling Stone magazine, and despite what Yoko may have, you know,
well,
said,
that's
you know,
the
that,
thing,
you know,
I think
you
that
know,
she
Plastic
totally
Band
him
album
up
is Sergeant Lennon. Yeah, but I think he, yeah,
you know,
but
you're a genius, you know, you need to be the.
But I don't think it robbed him of his perspective. I think he was well aware of what the truth was because he always came back to that, and even in that, you know, interview, he sort of says, yeah, you know, I still miss that thing where the musical understanding, where we could just look at each other and a nod or a wink and we'd know where we were going.
Well, he didn't miss it enough to act on it.
Yeah, but then again, none of them particularly did. George certainly didn't.
I think George wanted to work with John. And John was the one that was continually slamming the door in his face.
Sounds like you're being really coming down on John.
Well,
right
I'm
now.
Just trying to be... I'm not trying to do this through rose-colored glasses. You know,
I
respect his artistry, but I also think he undervalued the Lennon-McCartney partnership until it was too late, and I think he underestimated what the whole band brought to everybody's music.
But then,
I mean, for him to make an asinine statement in 1980 to Newsweek about, well, you know, in the context of the Beatles getting back together in 1980, you know, if George and Ringo joined us, is irrelevant since it was Paul and I that made the music. To say that with a straight face is a completely misunderstood everything that
yeah,
Beatles
but,
ever
no, but
did.
Hold on. In 1970, in that Rolling Stone Jan Wenner interview, he is saying that, you know, it wouldn't have been the Beatles without Ringo, it wouldn't have been the Beatles without George.
Right.
He acknowledges that.
He acknowledges that, but 10 years later, he's still promoting Yoko
listen,
as his artistic
Listen, it's
partner.
Lennon, man. You know, it's Lennon, right? Right. He will say what he wants to say, but that said, from his perspective, he had half his life still ahead of him. You know, he didn't know what was coming. And, you know, it's really impossible to speculate, but when people say, do you think the Beatles would have got back together if Lennon was still alive and, you know, George was still alive? Yeah, I think they would have. I don't think they'd have got together on a full-time basis.
Oh, no, no.
But I absolutely do think that, you know, regardless of what John said in 1980 or what he said in 1974 or whatever, you know, well, they would change on a dime, and he knew he could do that as well.
Just the underappreciation of what George Martin did for him. I'd re-record every single one of those songs, especially Strawberry Fields Forever.
I know, and George Martin said that to me. You know, he said, you know, he said that on an evening with him. He said, you know, George, there's not a song of mine that I wouldn't re-record. And it was like, really, John? You know,
I get that. You know, you never feel as an artist like you've totally done it. You know, I would say that about every one of my books. You know, I would totally redo them better. But you also need to have the perspective to recognize when you've hit that sweet spot. And I don't know that he did as the Beatles' last couple years went on. He was pulling away. I think he was reacting to Paul's ascendancy as trying to control things, but he wasn't really recognizing that his own stuff was really enhanced when you had Paul on board and the other guys behind. You know, it really took it to the next level.
Yeah, but you've got to also understand who John Lennon was, and you can't kind of cherry-pick what parts of his personality you would like to keep and the bits you want to get rid of. It's part of the whole picture, right?
No.
And you've got to remember, the guy who founded the group was also the guy that, right from the beginning, almost blew it up several times.
Oh, yes.
You know, whether it was beating up Bob Wooler, Beatles Bigger Than Christ, which wasn't really his fault, you know, but whatever. You know, Two Virgins, you know. So it's who he was. It's the nature of the man. You
and that's
know?
Why things played out the way they did. And
yeah.
Not the way that you can look in retrospect, had he had this insight at the time, it might have been better for everybody involved. The Beatles might have kept on creatively, you know, breaking new ground and producing great stuff.
He had the perspective also to know how disruptive the Yoko thing was. He knew what he was doing, bringing her into the studio. No one had done that before. But this is Lennon, right? He's going to challenge people. I know, you know, people who worked with him outside the studio and said the same thing. He would challenge you and see how you react. And if you could, like, suck it up a bit and go with it, mm-hmm. or even actually more likely stand up to him and come back at him with something that was valid, then he'd respect you. And I think that was part of the Beatles' makeup.
Right.
You know, that was their chemistry anyway.
Well, but the pattern with him was these alliances with people that, you know, once he recognized at a certain point that they weren't going to be the fulfilling of whatever it was he was going for, whether it's Arthur Janov or the Maharishi or whoever else, that he quickly discarded. Only Yoko he ended up staying with. And to my point of view...
After a fashion,
it was not to his betterment. And I'm not saying this to Yoko bash. I mean, he needed to keep his romantic and artistic life separate. I think it would have enhanced his legacy and made him worthy of the status he's achieved once he became martyred.
I've actually got no issues with John Lennon's career or any of his choices, to be honest, because I think, as I said, it's part of who it is. If you sort of say he should have done this, he should have done that, he wouldn't have been who he was, and then you wouldn't have got any of what you got from Please Please Me on. I mean, it's just, it is what it is. I think we're digressing here as well. You know, we've kind of gone off the beaten track here.
Well, okay, the circle back to Pepper, and we're talking about, you know, his asserting that it was a peak of his partnership with McCartney working together on an album. I mean, you can certainly see what Paul brought to his material. I think there's no better example than what was really a collaboration with them on A Day in the Life. And that would include George Martin in that as well. Because...
But how about saying what he brought to Paul's material on
yeah,
A Day
well,
in
absolutely.
The Life?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, not just A Day in the Life, but, you know, what he... She's Leaving Home is a song that I think is a great song that is burdened by a terrible arrangement. I hate it. It's cluttered. It's
Mike
busy,
Leander.
And it feels... Yes. And I did. I hated it before I knew it was Mike Leander. And I just thought it was... so contrived sounding to pull on the heartstrings. It was, you compare that to an Eleanor Rigby or Yesterday, you know, George Martin knew how to arrange strings so that it wasn't going for the obvious heavy-handed sentiment. And that's what that song suffers from. But John's contribution to Paul's song is beautiful in there. The counterpoint.
Yeah.
I mean, it's absolutely lovely. And that is a great example of Pepper, those two, really creating to a greater whole.
Well, that's the remarkable thing about Pepper. You know, there's always, you know, this talk where John sort of, you know, it was a collaborative hive between him and Paul, and that's exactly what it was, because George, I wouldn't say he's out of the picture, but he's certainly taken a few steps back. His mind is, you know, in matters in the East.
As we'll say later with Mark Lewison.
Yeah.
But that's the problem with Pepper, is no matter how well John and Paul work together, John was an acid casualty at that point. He was not the assertive, dominating figure he had been in the Revolver sessions, where he's bringing in all these new songs, and he kind of, like, you know, lost his wind halfway through it until he finally managed to put together She Said with George. But, you know, he has talked about being shamed into writing material for that album. You know, Mr. Kite, Lucy in the Sky, Good Morning are all tracks that I don't think rank among his finest compositions. They're great productions, they're great performances, but as statements, I don't think they hold up to things he did before.
Really? Lucy in the Sky?
No. Marshmallow Taxi, you know, I mean, Newspaper Taxis.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's great imagery.
Salad.
Come on.
No, it's hippy-dippy crap that I think he distanced himself from.
Whoa! Send the complaints to him, not me.
Hey, I'll take it on.
Yeah. No, seriously, I mean, I think it's actually, you know, maybe you're used to it now. You think, oh, Newspaper Taxis. But again, at the time, this is fantastic stuff. Who was putting this in rock songs, you know?
A lot of West Coast bands with stupid names.
No, not on that not that level of quality.
I think that it was, he did Stream of Consciousness better than that. I would point to I Am the Walrus, Cry Baby Cry. To me, it sounds so dated.
Yeah, but it's based on a kid's... based on a kid's drawing,
well, the title,
right?
Is. Not the whole thing they fill it up.
No, but it's the inspiration.
And I've contributed to that too.
And it's got the acid, as we know.
Absolutely.
He always kind of disclaimed that, but it doesn't really matter. But the fact is, it's got the acid influence in it. But he's certainly also inspired just by the colourful drawing and
he always said he was inspired by Lewis Carroll.
Yeah,
and that too. But
absolutely, which
but
is
so
huge.
Was I in the Walrus,
because that was a huge influence in his life, Lewis Carroll, right? You know, and we hear that also in Walrus. You know, but. I don't know. I couldn't really downplay that as one of his lesser compositions. I think it's just we're so used to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got the poppy chorus, you know,
yeah,
the sing-along chorus.
It's a great, I think it's catchy, you know, single material, really.
So I think it's a terrific track.
I just don't think it's one of his better compositions. And I'd say even more so for Kite.
Oh, no, again, I disagree. I actually think, you know, people say, oh, yeah, well, he just took the lyrics off the poster. Well,
right.
Okay. I'll hand you a poster, and it's like, try and do the same. It's still, and I know there's a lot of production, and there's the whole George Martin shtick, you know, which I find a bit unbelievable that he just threw the tapes up in the air, and this is what the result was.
Yeah.
I think that's all a bit fanciful thinking
sure.
as well. Revisionism. But I think, actually, it's absolutely brilliant that he takes that poster and infuses it, not just through production, but just his vocal delivery and the structure of the music. It gives it a kind of surreal feel to it. And that does blend in with the Pepper thing.
It does. It has that sort of performance aspect to it. If you're imagining that you're attending a show with the live audience sounds and Sgt. Pepper's band and all that stuff, that, funnily enough, I think works with the alleged concept to that album more than almost any other track on the album.
Mm.
But as a composition, I just don't rank it because it doesn't move me. It's interesting, it's novel, you know, it's not anything that I can listen to and think, you know, it'll give me something to think about. You know, it's not a Norwegian Wood or an In My Life or even a I'm Only Sleeping.
Okay, let's talk about what stuff do you think was really good that John did in the second
life.
In the second half of the Beatles' career.
I think the compositions he did, and there are a lot of really good band performances, funnily enough, on the White Album compositions he did. Dear Prudence, Happiness the Warm Gun, Your Blues, Sexy Sadie.
The band sounds great.
Cry Baby Cry, yeah. The band sounds great.
Everybody's Got Something Tied Except Me and My Monkey.
Yes.
Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Yeah.
And listen to those vocals as well.
Exactly.
He's belting.
Yes. But you get less of a sense of McCartney being invested in those songs in terms of harmony
and
vocals.
But does that actually detract? I don't think it detracts at all.
I think that...
There's some of the greatest Beatles songs.
They're great Beatles songs, but they're almost semi... solo Lennon songs under optimum conditions with a band that really got him. I would, to the other side of the coin, on Abbey Road, Oh Darling, you know, he always lamented he didn't get to sing that. Well, with the outtake that we hear on Anthology 3, where they're singing the harmony, why didn't they go with that arrangement? I mean, I know the answer, because things had deteriorated to that point that they weren't even going to sing on the same mic like they used to. You know that things had broken down to the point. And Paul is doing his own harmonies on a lot of the Abbey Road. They could have given each other so much.
But then we've still got some of the greatest three-part harmonies ever on Abbey Road.
On John's songs, which is very interesting. It's very striking. Because and Sun King.
And Because.
And Sun King.
Yeah.
And Because.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's very interesting that the avowed rock and roller of the band was the one who, on their final musical statement, had the most three-part harmonies. But I think that does underscore the fact that he really benefited from those guys supporting him.
Remember,
when he wasn't pushing them away, you know, and abandoning George in the studio.
Look at the photo from, what was it, 68, Life with the Lions, where it's the photo
with the white album pictures on the wall?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's John's choice, right? Yeah. It's his brother's, you know. Mm-hmm. It's John who gives a shout-out at the end of...
Just Because
on the rock and roll, you know, the outtake.
By that time, I think he came to recognize what he had burned to the ground.
Yeah, but I think also that, you know, John, I don't think he didn't recognize. That's my point. Where I disagree with you is I don't think he underappreciated or didn't recognize. I think, A, he was pissed that they, you know, didn't take to Yoko. So he was going to hit back and, you know, downplay them. But I think he was fully aware of what they had achieved. Yeah, you know, he was fully aware of it. And again, that was his choice. That was his choice. You know, that's John Lennon. I mean, he always did stuff. It pissed people off.
Anyway, A Day in the Life. Let's hear it.
Have the mic on the piano quite low. Just keeping it like maracas, you know. You know those old pianos.
Sugar Bum Fairy, Sugar Bum Fairy. I saw the photograph. He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was from the House of Lords. I saw a film today, oh boy. The English army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away. But I just had to look. Having read the book, I'd love to tell
you.
So,
interesting.
You see how they tried out different things during the Pepper sessions and had the good judgment to know when something worked and when it didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That the legendary Hum ending before they worked out the piano chord to A Day in the Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, it is actually. Fortunately, we didn't end up with the album, you know, with the closing track ending with Om.
Yeah.
That would have really dated it.
Right, it would have, yeah. I mean, but it's certainly not iconic.
Hmm.
Just out of, you know, little aside, I read somewhere that David Crosby was one of the people humming on that. Have you ever heard that story?
No.
Yeah.
Seen photos of him in the studio at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, interesting. Speaking of Hum, here's our tape at the fest, on stage in the ballroom, having our discussion with Mark Lewison on Was Sgt. Pepper the Beatles' creative peak?
But yeah, this was actually a really interesting discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Won't give anything away yet, but
no.
We were expecting conflicting views.
Chairs being thrown.
As you've seen today.
Yes.
And, chairs being thrown. Well, you'd have to play Hully Gully to, you know, start having the chairs getting thrown by the audience. But, it was kind of interesting the way that where this conversation leads and how it kind of resolves itself.
Yes. Here it is.
A couple of friends of mine and yours, probably too, Richard Buskin and Robert Rodriguez. These two guys are two of my favorite Beatle nerds. They know this stuff inside out, and they have a passion for it, and this should be fascinating, so enjoy. And I say nerd with the most affection I could possibly muster.
Okay, so my name is Richard Buskin.
I'm Robert Rodriguez, and thanks everybody for coming out to this.
So, in 1970, when he was interviewed by Jan Wenner for Rolling Stone magazine, Jan Wenner said to John Lennon, "You said to me, Sgt. Pepper is the one. That was the album." And John responded, "Well, it was a peak. Paul and I were definitely working together. I keep saying that I always preferred the double album because my music is better on the double album. I don't care about the whole concept of Pepper. It might be better, but the music was better for me on the double album because I'm being myself on it. I don't like production so much, but Pepper was a peak, all right." So as he said, it was a peak. As we know, the Beatles' career was full of peaks. Some may say it was one long peak. What I'd like to ask you, first of all, is do you think it should be viewed in that context as either, you know, that we can't actually differentiate between all the different peaks, or can we acknowledge that there was maybe progress in certain areas as they evolved?
It's a hard one. Richard and I go back a very long way, and we have these discussions among ourselves anyway. I'm of the opinion that, as you well put it, or put it so well, the peak was constant. And obviously there is a development, but if you try to say, was the White Album better than With the Beatles or Meet the Beatles? Yes and no, because Meet the Beatles, With the Beatles, whatever you want to call it, is a five-star record that couldn't be any better. And it changed everything, and it influenced so many people. So did the White Album, but the music is so radically different.
Yes.
I guess it depends on what kind of music you prefer, whether you think the White Album is more sophisticated. I suppose it is more sophisticated, but Meet the Beatles is, you know, just a wonderful, early, fresh, vibrant record. I don't quite know where I'm going with this answer. What was the question?
Well, the question is, do you think that if we view it that way, as a series of peaks or as one long peak, do you think we can still differentiate and say, yes, you know what, by 68 they were better songwriters or better musicians?
I think they were great songwriters all the way through and were writing wonderful songs that in each year, if you could take each year as a period, were the best songs that were being written by anybody really. I know what John means by when you read that quote of John's. He prefers the White Album, and yet Pepper was a peak. So what does he mean by that? And I think what he means is, as the culmination of so many ideas, and though he didn't like concepts particularly, it was something that they'd never done before, to actually coalesce all their thoughts into that kind of one vision, if you like. And in that respect, and the way that he and Paul worked together, it was a peak. And there's no doubt that Pepper had a far greater influence over the world than the White Album did.
Yeah.
But John's songs on the White Album were better than his songs on Pepper.
Yes.
So...
Better than yes. A Day in the Life, which is hard, isn't it?
Well, you know, how do you... I mean, every song on the White Album is strong, but every song on Pepper is strong. I personally, I'm one of those guys who, if I had to give 100, out of marks out of 100 to Beatles tracks, most of them will be 100.
Yes.
So it's very hard to actually say what's better than the next.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many different angles to unpack that statement and that assessment that was a peak in the Beatles' career. A peak of what? If he is referring to the partnership of his with Paul McCartney's, and in the context of that quote, he was speaking of A Day in the Life in particular, of how well they worked together on that song. And certainly it's the strongest thing that John had any ownership of on that album. It was very much a Lennon-McCartney collaboration.
Was he just talking about that? Because, you know, these rock band mixes that we have now, thanks to that video game, I was astonished listening to the Pepper vocal isolations, how much John and Paul were working together on every track.
Yes, and with a conspicuous absence of George.
Yeah.
Who was really withdrawing from the band at that point. His heart and his head were in India. And in fact, you know, Paul handles quite a bit of the lead guitar on that album. So it represents an apex of something, but what we want to examine and maybe discuss a bit here is of what exactly? Is that of the Beatles as this four-man unit all on the same page, or is there really some other dynamic there for that album that was propelling it? You know, it's been suggested that it was Paul McCartney and George Martin's baby. John was being dragged along to write songs, you know, a Corn Flakes commercial inspiring Good Morning, Good Morning, a antique circus poster inspiring Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite. You know, the one undeniably inspired piece of songwriting was A Day in the Life and the production that it took on.
Do you want to come in on that? When you look at it, you as you say, Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, the idea came from a program, Good Morning, Good Morning. He heard a Kellogg's commercial with the cockerel crowing, and that was the prompt for him to write that. What else is there? With a Little Help, he co-wrote with Paul. But A Day in the Life is also a newspaper song as well. And I think the simplest way of putting it is that he was at a point in his head when he was enjoying the idea of writing songs based on everyday things that cropped up in his life. But, I mean, Mr. Kite is an extraordinary song. It wouldn't have come without the poster, of course, because it is the poster is the song.
Well, do you rank it as a song or rank it as a production?
Song.
Do you? As a composition?
Yeah.
Yeah, so do I. I mean, who else could do that? It's one thing saying, well, a lot of the words were there, but to put it into the form that he ended up putting it in is just brilliant.
Of course, it ended up being produced. It had to be produced. It was one of those tracks that needed the ambience of the funfair or the circus or whatever.
Right, that's where it really shines, in my opinion, is as a production to evoke what he is getting at, this whole circus atmosphere, which you can, you know, make sort of a metaphor for the times.
As a composition, it's sort of unique within his catalog of works, because really the stuff that he really shined with was the personal stuff that really actually meant something to him. And I think that is why he has so embraced his White Album songs, because that was where he was really, you know, invigorated again, and after having this period where he was, you know, dropping an awful lot of acid between 66 and 67, he was suddenly interested in articulating his own inner life again.
When you listen to some of the outtakes of Sgt. Pepper, John does sound fairly out of it. There's Paul having to give him direction on how to sing Mr. Kite, or Lucy in the Sky, I think, with maximum effectiveness. And John seems to be fairly lost, actually, and without Paul there to actually say, no, do it this way, producing him in a sense.
Right, absolutely.
Well, we have to bear in mind that John himself said, I took over 1,000 acid trips, so it had to have had some effect.
Yeah, all in one day.
Now, Robert, I mean, you're strongly of the feeling as well that as a unit, their peak, it, just in that aspect, as a functioning unit, was the Revolver album.
I think that at the peak of their powers as a, you know, the four-headed monster, as Mick Jagger called them, all pulling in the same direction, wanting to advance the goalposts in rock music. You know, they go into the studio in early 1966 having this bounty of time because they didn't make the third film that year. And the first thing they lay down is Tomorrow Never Knows, which utterly throws away the rule book and everything they knew on how to make records to that point. You know, it's really
you know, of the four of them, Paul is the one that didn't move to the stock broker belt. He's living in London, very much tapped into the counterculture of the times. And he's the one that, with John's composition based on the Timothy Leary psychedelic experience book, is the one that brings in the overlay of the tape loops that creates that and takes it to the next level. And it's also as an example of the four of them all pulling together. Tomorrow Never Knows, you've got Ringo playing that tremendous hypnotic drum beat that sounds like a loop, except it's not. You know, something totally different from anything he'd ever done before. And George throwing in his tambura, getting that exoticism into it. And, you know, Paul playing the backwards guitar solo that ends up, you know, being in the middle of the song. It really is a great example of all four of them contributing to the greater whole and this quantum leap forward from the last time they've been in the studio together.
It's interesting that though Paul was the counterculture Beatle, or so we're told, actually most of the countercultural stuff the Beatles did was actually done by John.
But it was on John's compositions.
But yeah. Paul is there helping out, making it happen. Yeah, enabling it. Yeah. It's interesting that Paul was an enabler of John's in the same way that John was an enabler of Paul's, and that's part of their chemistry.
And that's where I think their greatest strength lies, is when they were enabling each other. I mean, it's sort of a truism that they canceled out each other's weaknesses and each had something to bring to the table that enhanced the quality of each other's material. Mm. And by the time of the White Album, where they're really sort of disengaging and they're really calling their own shots and their own songs, is where you start to see the breakdown in this esprit de corps to that point.
Although, did the breakdown then really occur around Pepper because George wasn't as involved?
I think Robert's right in that the last album on which all four of them were really pulling together would be Revolver.
Yeah.
Because undoubtedly they were still a band on Pepper, but George was in his head. He was in India and he was really not playing the guitar very much. I mean, what George's tracks on Sgt. Pepper was Within You, Without You, which he wrote on a harmonium, and he tried to get Only a Northern Song on there, which he wrote on a Hammond organ. These weren't even guitar songs.
Yeah, and the other 67 song he did, It's All Too Much, another one based on organ.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so much a lead guitar player
and
at
Blue
that point.
Blue Jay Way. Blue Jay Way was the same.
Right.
That was a keyboard song.
That's
so
right.
The guitarist is writing keyboard songs suddenly,
yes.
Which is an interesting development.
When is it... What is the first George track that John doesn't play on?
Oh.
Something on the White Album?
Yeah, no, Something's on Abbey Road. Sorry. Yeah, it's a White Album. I forget which, but it was something I began to uncover when writing the recording sessions book, is that, oh, John wasn't on this session when George was recording. And then it happened again and again, and suddenly a pattern is emerging whereby he's not there.
Right.
Which is interesting,
or
to say
George
the least.
Would say he wasn't there.
He wasn't there.
And then when he does show up for George recording Old Brown Shoe, George wipes the guitar part that John played.
Did he?
Yeah.
I've forgotten that.
It's in your book.
All right, I must read it. I don't know. It's a long time ago.
For me, you know, a later period song that shows them all pulling together as a unit is Hey Bulldog.
Yes.
And that obviously, that was done before they went to India.
Right, February 68.
The week before they flew to India.
Yeah. Mm. So actually when they come back from India, it's not quite the same, is it?
Well, India is the big turning point in the Beatles for me. And it's never really been looked at properly and does need to be so, because when the group that came back from India was not the same one that went there.
And why do you suspect that is? I know, as you said, you haven't done the in-depth research yet, but what would you suspect? Is it about the split about, you know, John turning on the Maharishi and George still buying into it, or?
No, I think John and, I don't know. I don't know all the answers to that, but I'm looking. I do know that George was cross with Paul for leaving early, and then for returning to London and doing all sorts of things in George's name that he didn't know about until he got home, i.e. Apple. George returned from India to find that Apple was doing this and this with his money, and he didn't know anything about it until he returned. He was disappointed that Paul didn't take the course as seriously as he believed he would.
There was also the fact that now Yoko was entering the scene, because she was communicating with John in India.
Yes. Yes, and that's, of course, another huge shift right there.
Yeah.
In Yoko is on the scene and the moment they get back, really.
Yeah.
So as soon as they begin the sessions for the White Album, they're in trouble.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Could we play a little bit of Hey Bulldog, actually, and just see all four of them in the studio? This was filmed where? Was this at Trident?
Number 3 studio at EMI.
All right.
Abbey Road.
Right. Yeah.
Suddenly, come 1968, it's back to basics rock and roll. Now, how would you view that in the arc of their career? Would you look at that as arcing in another question, in another direction, or if some people suggested it was a retreat?
No, they were just always moving on. They did Pepper with this, you know, highly produced sound and its elaborate production in every sense. And now they're going to do, well, we've done that, now let's do something else. I mean, in 69, only a year after this, they were intent on recording without overdubbing, even.
Right.
That's not retreat, it's just, let's try this. So I don't see it as anything different. In 68, anyway, all sorts of bands were suddenly returning to rock. I mean, it wasn't just the Beatles doing the White Album.
The band.
Yeah, the band, The Who, The Stones. They were all doing rock albums again. And psychedelia, so cool, which I think is always overplayed anyway, was last year's thing.
Well, do you recognize that maybe the Beatles saw that with Pepper and with all the accolades it drew, you know, they had been on the forefront, the cutting edge of advancing the sound of rock. And now, it's not them that's leading the charge. It's other acts. You know, you look at the up-and-comers in 67. You know, the Beatles' closest peers were kind of by the wayside in 67. You got Brian Wilson having had his breakdown with Smile. He's not really doing anything. The Stones are in and out of drug court. Dylan is still recovering from his motorcycle accident. So they're closest competitors. And the up-and-comers are Cream, The Doors, you know, Pink Floyd, these psychedelic,
yeah,
you know, non-traditional pop acts.
Yeah, the whole scene had evolved by this point. Obviously, Pepper was the turning point in the development of the album as the primary format for these artists to express themselves. Suddenly, the single is no longer it. They want to have hits, perhaps, but they want to express themselves better on the in the LP. Pepper was the great advancement for the album. It was no longer just a collection of tracks. It would be something that an artist could express himself on.
I think something about Pepper, and this is not diminishing its quality and the effect that it had at the time, but the fact that it was so cutting edge and it was so much of its time, for me personally, has dated it a bit.
Well, it's locked into, for many people, it's locked into the Summer of Love.
Yes.
Whereas you don't necessarily need to know when the other albums came out, they're just the albums.
Right.
It can't help but suffer with that, but I don't think it should actually diminish the quality of the product. But it does, I know what you mean, it does. Yeah. People associate it very strongly with a period, which for the other albums isn't quite the case.
Let's take it back, all the way back to the beginning, because I know in terms of the English releases, you know, I think we'd all agree that the With the Beatles album is just, again, one of their great, great albums.
Yeah.
A lot of people do diminish the Please Please Me album. I actually love the Please Please
Me
album.
Me too.
I think it's dated. It sounds, you know, their backing vocals aren't as sophisticated. The production isn't as sophisticated.
It sounds pre-Beatles.
Yeah. but I still think it's actually a fabulous album.
It is. It sounds what the tape captured what happened that day, which was a cold winter's day in England in 1963 when they've got 10 hours to record 10 tracks and John's got a cold and they don't have any time to actually, as Americans would say, finesse anything. You know, they've just got to move on. Next one, move on. I feel for Ringo on that album the most. I don't mean his drumming, I mean boys. He's never sung in a recording studio before. This is the first record he's ever going to sing on. He's got one take. It does it as well. In fact, they play it fantastically. But one take, can you imagine? I mean, and then that's it forever. We're still listening to that one take of this as John would have said, this frantic guy just trying to do his best.
And of course, no overdubbing, was it? It was just a live vocal.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which John had to do with Twist and Shout.
Yep, yep. But that's part of its beauty, of course, isn't it? No, Please Please Me is fantastic, but obviously once they had the opportunity to stretch out in the studio and to experiment, then the other albums were going to sound more sophisticated.
I mean, another aspect I wanted to bring in was how quickly they evolved. I mean, the difference between Please Please Me and with the Beatles is just a matter of months, and yet it's light years of difference.
Yeah.
And certainly in the first half of their career, as, you know, international artists, those albums, there was a different sound to every album, wasn't there, really? Yeah. There's, you know, the Rickenbacker 12-string sound of A Hard Day's Night. We've got the
rockabilly of Beatles for Sale.
Yeah, exactly. The sort of, you know, really it is a country sound of Beatles for Sale. The Hammond organ sound on Rubber Soul and
Help.
Yeah, and yeah.
Can I ask you two guys, what would you say if you had to choose the album in which the Beatles least expressed themselves or least progressed, what would you say it was?
Mostly it's in that period of Beatles for Sale and Help.
Yeah.
Because the next real leap is Rubber Soul.
Right, yes. Definitely yes. Help. That was kind of the last gasp of being a beat group.
Yeah, Help for me is the one where their music has progressed the least since the last one.
Right, but there are early clues to the new direction.
There are.
Yesterday, for example.
Yesterday being a great track, and Help and Ticket to Ride. And
yes.
Of course, we're going to name all 14 tracks and say we love it, because we do. But on the other hand, I think probably that was the period when it was all getting a bit too much for them and they had no room to breathe even.
It was that kind of period of just doing more of the same, wasn't it, really?
Yeah. So was Sgt. Pepper the Beatles' creative peak, yes or no?
Well, again, I would go back to, if you want to rank Beatles' greatness as all four of them advancing and helping each other's art, I can't say that that's true of Pepper. I would never argue against Pepper being a sociological phenomenon with you know, the changing the currency from the single to an album-length statement in rock. However, you know, you could probably count on one hand the number of things influenced directly by Pepper that were worth a damn that came after it.
Yeah.
You know, you could also make the case that it was dated by 1969.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, favorite Beatles album?
The White Album. For me, in terms of the sort of how they basically had really matured as songwriters, the messages in a lot of the songs, and also just the musical eclecticism, you know, that we get to hear all of their influences and also where they're beginning to lead the way. We've got proto-punk, we've got heavy metal, we've got country, we've got music hall. Mm. You know, it's like there's everything. There's, I don't know if there's any artist has ever done anything that broad range.
Yeah, yeah. For me, it changes every day, but today it's the White Album. Yeah.
It is. I rank Revolver as perhaps the crest of the wave of four-man Beatle creativity, but as far as a collection of songs go, I would have to go with the White Album.
Yeah. Wow, we've got a consensus here. And that wasn't planned.
No,
not at all. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. You know, just hope you tune in to hear the show, Something About the Beatles. Go to somethingaboutthebeatles.com. And thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Richard. Could I just do the obligatory ad before the music comes on? Just to say Robert's books, all of them are available in the Fest Room. Richard's book, Beatles 101, is available in the Fest Room, and I'm signing just out there. So thank you very much.
Thank you,
everyone.
So we didn't know that, did we?
Hardly, yeah. I mean, I knew that, you know, I obviously knew what I was going to, you know, where I was going with this, that I was going to end with the White Album. I mean, that is, if I had to take one Beatles album to the desert island with me, that would be the one.
That'd be the one.
I wasn't sure with you. I had a feeling you might go towards that, but there was always the chance that you'd pull for Revolver, so I wasn't sure.
Yeah, more Beatles
and
than less Beatles.
Him, I had absolutely no idea.
You guys have talked about this forever,
yeah, we've spoken about it forever, and I was really surprised, actually, that this kind of I think, yeah, because he actually comes up with it, you know, and it's like, whoa, okay, we're in agreement here.
Did he say it? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but I had no clue that that's where it was heading.
So we can't accuse him of sucking up to us.
No, and but I can accuse him of actually surprising me in a really unexpected way.
Yeah, my expectation had been he would say, oh, they're all great.
Mm. Although he did sort of say that is like today. Yeah, you know, it's today. Tomorrow it could be. And that's fair enough.
I've been stuck on White Elm for a long time. That hasn't really changed.
I agree.
And I would say, wait for it. My favorite Beatle track, if somebody had to ask me, and people have, for the longest time, and I don't know it's going to move too much from this, Strawberry Fields.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know if I've got a favorite Beatles track. That's really, really difficult. I mean, one of them that would stand out for me would be Happiness is a Warm Gun.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of right
great
up there.
Band performance.
And Hey Bulldog for a really great group performance. But, I mean, my God.
What are your least favorite?
Least favorite? Well,
I've gone on record. I know you've said you don't like Dig a Pony.
Don't like Dig a Pony. Don't particularly like I Saw Her Standing There.
Really?
Yeah. Don't particularly like Drive My Car.
Wow.
I know. I mean, I don't hate them. And I wouldn't say they're my least favorite.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are the non-Beatles compositions like Mr. Moonlight, Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby. Yeah, the sort of Beatles for Sale, some of those tracks I'm not crazy on either.
Well, yeah, I think every fan would recognize they were tired and the cover-heavy stuff was maybe...
Taste of Honey, you know, I mean, they're okay. I mean, are there any Beatle tracks I absolutely hate? I don't think so, you know.
Mary Jane.
Huh?
Mary Jane?
Yeah, not a favorite. Revolution 9, interesting, but not like, you know.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you would.
I would, and I do.
Yeah. I remember playing that like when I was in my teens and my mother coming in, this is madness, what are you listening to?
Wait, you hear it backwards, Mom.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there are ones that I'll kind of, you know, if I'm listening in the car and they'll come on that I most likely will skip. Yeah. You know, but...
yeah, there's an awful, you know...
I've always loved We Can Work It Out. That's one of, you know, a favorite. Mm-hmm. Always loved Please, Mr. Postman.
Really?
Yep.
That's one of my lesser favorite ones.
Oh, I love that. The Lennon vocal and the very subtle Beatles harmonies in the background. Mm. You know, that's one thing we're talking about, how they evolved, and we spoke about that with Mark. I mean, that, you know, from the beginning of 63, the Please Please Me album, to the end of 63, or, you know, the autumn of 63, whatever, with the Beatles, how the backing vocals have evolved, you know.
Yes.
And you hear that on Please, Mr. Postman. Is
well, yeah,
superb.
I mean, that would be an example... And Devil in Her Heart would be an example. Those
are
cover songs.
Fantastic covers.
But the ones that they did that were their own material, the call and response, and I've said this before in the show, It Won't Be Long.
Mm-hmm.
A great, exciting, exuberant... I mean, the thing about that album
absolutely.
Is
what
so much energy.
Absolutely.
It's like the optimum live performance out of those
guys. Well, it's interesting, again, going back to the Roy Carr, Tony Tyler book of 75, the illustrated record, where he says it sounds as fresh today as on the day of release.
Sure.
That was 12 years, you know, after its release. Now, 50 years after its release,
right.
I personally think it does still sound
absolutely.
As fresh.
And that's so true of so much of their stuff.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, Revolver sounds like it could have been recorded last week.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's so much to that, and I wouldn't say that about Pepper, though.
Yeah, and I actually remember in, again, I'd say it was mid-70s, Mike McCartney, then Mike McGeer, he was in some kind of roundtable discussion, it was interviews in either NME or Melody Maker, and again, you know, one of the highlighted quotes was, how far have we come from Abbey Road, you know, like since 1969, how far have we progressed since then, you know, the inference
what, rock
being...
generally?
Yeah, rock generally, you know, the inference being that we really haven't progressed that far. And I would say that, yeah, apart from sonic, you know, technological advances, I don't think we've actually advanced.
Mm.
That was an amazing decade, not just in the hands of the Beatles, but, you know, a lot of their peers.
Speaking of advance, that was something I touched on a little bit in the ballroom. You know, when the Beatles got all the innovation out of their system in 1967, and from then on it was songcraft and production... I've often wondered if, you know, the peer group they had in 67 that weren't really doing much of anything.
Yeah.
All these new faces come out. You know, Airplane had a great album that year.
Yeah.
Jimi Hendrix Experience, Pink Floyd.
Yes.
You know, Cream was having a great year. I wonder if the Beatles recognize on some level that they would not be able to compete with that in terms of instrumental prowess, in terms of getting really far afield from rock. As they had known it to this point, because they were still steeped in their music hall traditions and, you know, everything that had taken them that far.
I think the Beatles just did what they did. I'm serious. I mean, who knows? We're not inside their heads. We're not inside the studio with them to know what the discussions were. Or, you know, at Cavendish Avenue or something, you know, between John and Paul.
I think they felt they'd taken the boundaries as far as they needed to go and got the validation for it. I mean, they were just crowned the kings in 1967 with Pepper, followed by All You Need Is Love. You know, not so much Magical Mystery Tour, but, you know, they were as far as any band had gone in universal acclaim. And unifying the world over a single musical statement.
And no one actually ever matched them on that.
Right, and I don't think they ever needed to do that again. They
Correct.
Felt like they'd done that.
Yeah, well, I agree. I think that, you know, up through Revolver, actually, let's say even through Pepper. Through Pepper, they're making it. After Pepper, they've made it. And that particularly shows, I think, in Paul's attitude and in his songwriting.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it continued to be fantastic, you know, through the end of the Beatles' career, I can just see signs of a certain, to me, a certain sort of glibness, a bit of an arrogance going on.
Self-satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Which is not to say they never
innovated. He didn't have to prove himself ever again, anymore.
But they, you know, there'd been the pattern, you know, Rubber Soul, Revolver, Pepper, of advancing, you know, the studio craft as well as, you know, what they were bringing in terms of arrangements to the table and doing something different. You know, the tape manipulation and all that stuff. That's kind of by the wayside. But then you've got something like Hey Jude that comes up in mid-68, you know, tremendously innovative in a different way.
Yeah, well, as I've said, you know, if Paul McCartney had only ever done two songs in his entire career that people knew of, and they were Lady Madonna and Hey Jude, that wouldn't be too bad. That might get him in the Hall of Fame right there.
Sorry, put Lady Madonna in there.
Huh?
Lady Madonna, that's a big favorite of yours?
I think it's a fantastic song as well, yeah.
Fantastic song when it was first recorded in the 50s, too.
Okay, well, I think that wraps it up.
Yes.
For this video version of Something About the Beatles.
Yes, more to come.
More to come, folks.